Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, Sony is back, but are they better than ever? And there's some controversy brewing over on the iPhone App Store side of things. But is Google staying out of the maelstrom? We will dig into it. And in the second half of our show, it's the past is all about the future. That didn't make any sense, but that's okay because we have a couple people who are a lot smarter than me to explain it. Andrew Martinick, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. I don't have as much past to talk about as Michael does. He's been playing with some very, very fun gadgets.
You spoiled the surprise. But I'm so happy and thrilled to welcome Michael Fisher, Mr. Mole, back to the show. What's going on? How are you?
Gentlemen, it seems like it's been an eon since I've seen y'all's faces through this podcast lens. And what's going on is I'm in a sound booth with no air conditioning on a hot day, but it's not as hot as seeing y'all again. So thanks for having me back.
Oh, that's a take.
Yeah.
So you've been working hard. You've published 5 videos in the last 7 days, which if I can count correctly.
you cannot, but I will take it.
Oh, how many videos? Six?
No. There's only a handful. The usual 2 or 3 per week. But they're all coming together in collections.
You are extremely prolific at the moment. Under trying conditions, you've been putting out some really good stuff.
Thanks, man.
To have you on. You've been covering a lot of older phones, products, things that you're revisiting. You've got this very successful and popular new series called When Phones Were Fun, which I want to talk about. But first, I just want to talk about you. How are you? How's life under lockdown?
You know, it's getting better all the time, I have to say. I keep trying not to dwell on this too much or harp on it, but I'm just really glad that this all happened in the spring, or the winter into the spring, because, you know, we know how to be careful now. We know how to what not to do. And one of the things you can do is go outside and safely enjoy yourself. And this weather over the past few weeks has been so excellent. And New York City has been so beautiful. I have sat many evenings on the river and looked at it. And sometimes with friends 6 to 10 feet away. And it's just been lovely. So really, I'm in a very good headspace. So thank you for asking. And I hope everyone out there is also making the most of this difficult situation. I know it's not as easy for some. So keeping that in mind. But I'm doing well.
And I don't want to be too didactic on this podcast, but your videos feature you wearing a very fashionable mask a lot of the time in your outdoor shots.
And yes.
I do want to say wear your mask if you're not somebody who is thinking that you are susceptible, because things are looking good, but they're also in parts of the country are looking slightly dire or more
Absolutely.
Dire than they were a few weeks ago. So. But you two are based in New York, where things seem to be on the up and up.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's what prudence will get you.
Yes, dear Prudence. it's getting better all the time. Just a lot of Beatles references this morning.
Wow, is that what that was? See, my memory record only extends to the early 1990s, Daniel Bader. I don't know. I don't know about these bugs.
Yeah, when phones were fun.
All right, exactly.
So, Andrew, we'll start with this story that you wrote about Apple's onerous and inconsistent App Store rules, and how
I love the use of the word onerous.
It's a beautiful word, and it really does speak to the way that a lot of developers are feeling about the App Store today. And yet, you write, developers still go to Apple first over Google. This controversy started over something that Jason Fried and DHH, who's I should have his name in front of me, but I don't.
David Hennemeyer Hansen.
Hansen, thank you. They published a new email app called Hey. It was accepted into the App Store, and then an update was subsequently rejected because it did not follow the App Store rules. And the rules say that you cannot have an app that essentially does not work out of the box. And Hey requires a subscription that you sign up for on the company's website. And it does not allow an in-app purchase in the app itself.
Mm-hmm.
So talk us through what's going on here and why the same policy is not really Google's policy, why it doesn't matter to Google to have those same, you know, onerous you know, rules. And yet, this is a way bigger deal for iPhone users than it is for Android users.
Yeah, and this is the thing. The reason why this one's getting so much attention is multifaceted. Obviously, yeah, so Hey is a, I guess, a division or another app coming out of Basecamp, which is a very valuable company with a very wealthy co-founders, and you know they can afford to fight it, so they can afford to make a big kerfuffle over it. But also, it's the same thing happening over and over in the App Store, where you have really strict policies, and they are policies. They're not like unwritten rules or anything like that. They are rules, but they're not enforced evenly. And they all circle around this constant push and pull of Apple wants a 30% cut of any in-app purchases. And that extends to subscriptions as well. And they only recently have a small reduction where I believe it's the second year of a subscription, it goes down to 15%. And so you get that small benefit. But it generally comes from app developers want to have access to the App Store, and they want to have their users subscribe to their service outside of the App Store. But Apple doesn't want that to happen. And normally, they just, you know, developers just deal with it. But this one was particularly bad because Apple let the app in the store and then, in the words of the app developer, kind of held it hostage and said, we're gonna pull your app and never let it back in if you don't let your, or make, I guess, your users subscribe to the app. And to Daniel's point, that what happens, unfortunately, is if you were to not subscribe to the email app and you download it, because it's free to download, the app just opens and does nothing. Oof. Because Apple's policy also does not let you have a splash screen or something on first open that says, hey, this is not a free app. Click this link or go to, you know, hey.com and subscribe. They don't let that happen either, because once again, they want the payment to come through them. And to Basecamp's credit, they're saying, screw you, we're not going to do it. They said, I think there's no way in a million years I'm going to let Apple take 30% of my revenue, was the quote. And it's kind of hard to blame them, but also it's like, well, the policy is the policy, and you have to play by that. And that's kind of the whole premise of that article, is that this has been the case for a long time. There's this policy and dozens of others that are really onerous and hard to deal with. But the hard numbers are that developers are making 60%+ more money on subscriptions on iOS than on Google and Google Play. And the overall revenue of the top apps in the App Store is 3 to 4 times what it is for the top apps in the Play Store. So right. You just deal with it.
Mm. Yeah. And that really is what is being reinforced here, that this is a company whose apps are available on Android, iOS, and Windows on day one. And yet it's really making this splash because of what's happening on iOS, Mac as well, but the same policies apply on Mac OS, and the user base is much smaller on the Mac App Store. I find it interesting here because we don't really hear about the struggles that developers go through on the Play Store nearly as often. Largely because it feels like it's just an endemic problem that developers have a hard time making money on the Play Store. And I want to bring this to Android because it is relevant, where you often hear about companies either having far fewer developers on the Android side of things or not investing as much money or just not bringing their apps to Android until there is a viable kind of single code-based solution, right? So that they're not really developing a native app. They're just using a shared framework that they can roll out an app across all of their platforms. And yet those are the apps that perform the worst in terms of just sheer, you know, smoothness and user experience. Michael, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, but It seems like, you know, this is a slippery slope, especially a couple days before WWDC, for Apple to be digging itself a hole like this.
It's tricky, but you know what it does? It annoys me because, first of all, it is annoying and outrageous and onerous for all the reasons that Andrew wrote. But there's a great passage in the article where it's like, that's really bad. But these types of situations happen regularly, and developers just deal with it. And you have to if you're a developer, right? Because you need to be on the App Store. The thing that annoys me about it is it reminds me of this constant truth that I run into over and over again. We may not get to talking about it, but I'm wearing a new smartwatch this week, and I downloaded the app for Android and synced it. And you know what? That app on the Play Store has like a 2.8 star rating because it kind of sucks. Well, yeah. Over on the Apple App Store, it's got like a 4.3 or something, and it has mostly positive feedback in the comments because, what do you know, the iPhone app is better. And I'm so tired of the iPhone app so often being better because of some of the same forces you guys are talking about. It's like you can't not play in the App Store, and if you only have the developing resources to focus on one of the two, then you're going to do the iPhone. And I just hate that is still the truth in 2020. So
and the money disparity is so large there, mm-hmm. that, like I said, even if you don't want to give Apple 30% of your revenue, you're still coming out ahead giving Apple 30% of your revenue
then
because you're making 60
story.
Yeah, because you're making 60% more money. And of course, you know, I mentioned in the article, Google's not free from controversy or free from criticism over how much it charges, because it also charges 30% on in-app purchases. And the good user experience is to have that native payment system where you want to upgrade or you want to subscribe and you tap the button and it pops up Apple Pay or Google Pay and you're just done in two taps, mm-hmm. and a fingerprint or whatever. The bad user experience is sending people out to your own subscription model anyway. But the problem is that you're paying the same cut no matter what. And I think a lot of people for a long time have called for Google to try to be more competitive there. But really, you know, they have to run a store too. They want to make some money off of it too. Their wins are in, you know, the flexibility that you can have your own payment system or subscription system or whatever you want to do. And they just try to make it more appealing from user experience perspective to use theirs.
Right. Yeah.
I go through the Play Store's rankings a lot, and I look at what's top grossing, what's top paid, how many downloads say the top paid game has, or the top trending game. I look at something like Dead Cells, which was a hugely anticipated PC game port. It was about 9 months late to Android from when it came to iOS. That's not uncommon. It's a $8.99 game, so it's expensive by mobile game standards, but it's certainly not even close to as expensive as it is on Switch or PC. And it has 10,000 downloads. So this is a $9 game, 10,000
wow.
plus downloads. So not a small number by Android Android standards. But I just wonder, you know, if developers do this because they kind of have no choice. I mean, is it's this inevitable push pull where, you know, yes, they're going to make some money on Android, but it won't be a lot. We've heard a lot of developers leaving apps in purgatory because they just don't have the resources to invest in maintaining them.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Android is still 85% of the global smartphone market. So, you know, where they don't really have a choice. There, you know, every free app, every free game is available.
Yeah, but when it comes down to, you talk about 85% of the market being Android, it's what percentage of the market are paying customers.
Yes.
Is dramatically smaller than that. And obviously it gets outweighed by the smaller portion of people spending a ton more money on iOS. And there are lots of demographic reasons for that. But, you know, like you said, you're going to get lots of free apps and apps that have other business models. Like, you're going to have an app from, you know, every bank and financial institution because the market is large. But anything that requires a subscription or relies or is really enhanced by $5 to $10 of in-app purchases or something like that is not going to make it over because you know, the economics don't work, and it's just going to be a chicken and the egg problem. I'm not really sure how Google can solve that. You know, we've seen it a million different times. You can't just pay developers to be there. You can't, even if you made the rev share, you know, 5% from Google's perspective, it's still not going to close that gap anyway.
And Michael, you know, you've talked, you did a video a week ago or so about the Huawei P40 Pro Plus, and you focus on the camera, mm-hmm. which is, you know, unimpeachable. You cannot argue that this is not a fantastic piece of hardware, but yeah. the Huawei App Gallery is inherently limited in its distribution, especially yeah. for Western apps. And you talk about Google's inherent disadvantage, even though it has sheer numbers, but from a revenue perspective, that gulf is massive between the Play Store and the App Store. And then you're looking at something like the App Gallery, which is starting from nothing.
Yeah.
They basically are in the Windows Phone position of having to pay developers to port their apps over.
And that's the brutal thing, because not even Microsoft could make that work. I mean, you had Microsoft not just saying, hey, we'll give you a discount. You had Microsoft saying the reverse. We will literally pay you to make apps for our platform, and still getting the door slammed in their face. In that kind of environment, with those kind of forces at work, yeah, I do not see how anyone can survive, let alone prosper.
And yet, I mean, I just want to end this conversation by saying, and yet, after a year and a half of Epic Game Store exclusivity, Epic brought Fortnite to the Play Store a few weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
likely because it knew that it was just losing out on potential revenue and just, you know, sheer player engagement by not being mm-hmm. on the Play Store, because that is where people expect apps to be. And they're yep. probably getting angry emails from people being like, I don't know how to download your game, because even though it's fairly easy to sideload an app, you know, it's not as easy as opening up the Play Store and pressing install.
Well, remember, if you have complaints like that, let's just make sure everybody knows where to send them. You have to send them to androidcentral.com, because those are the people in charge of Android. So you have to let them know.
Oh, we know that. I mean, that actually is a really good example of what we're dealing with across the App Store and Google Play. Fortnite, or Epic Games, which makes Fortnite, they know that they tapped out all the people who would play Fortnite and download it through their sideload system. And then they moved over to Google Play to just get additional users that they weren't going to come over and sideload it anyway. In many ways, you see that happen with the App Store and Google Play. You tap out the entire addressable market of people for your type of app in the App Store, and then you go looking for additional people on Google Play. Once that the marginal cost of adding an additional user is not, you know, gets low enough after you've already topped out on iOS, you just ride out the long portion of that curve over on Google Play. You're never going to see, because each incremental user is much more valuable on the App Store than on Google Play. Why wouldn't you want the most valuable additional users to be first on the App Store? It works out every time.
And look, if you have an ad-based business model, it makes sense to invest as much money as you can in making a great Android experience, because there you just have the eyeballs, right? Even an old crappy Android phone from 5 years ago is going to be able to scroll through many ads with no problem. So it's mainly just you have to identify the business model, and Hey does not have that kind of business model. It's not ad-based. It's the opposite. It's $100 a year for the ability to send email to at hey.com email address, which is a pretty niche prospect anyway.
Yeah, you don't say.
$999 a year for a 2-word email address, which is nuts. Like I tried to, for S and giggles, I put in db@hey.com, $1,000 a year. How many people are going to do that? I don't know. It's probably you can count on one hand right now. But anyway,
I don't want to know most of them.
Most of them live in San Francisco.
You don't want hey.com?
I would prefer no one hey me. No, yes. No. Please stop.
Hey now. All right, let's move on, talk about a bit of hardware. So Michael, you have the Xperia 1 Mark II in-house. This is a phone that launches in late July, so a while from now still. We're talking about over a month as of recording this.
Yep.
And yet, a lot of YouTubers have pre-production models, and they've reviewed them already. I'm very curious about this phone because the narrative around it seems to be that Sony did good. Sony corrected a lot of the problems of the Xperia Z line, that it really, really, even though it kept to the same form factor, really fixed the camera from the Xperia 1, and that they're digging, they're doubling down on Pro, whatever that means. And if you're really into shooting video and shooting manual photos, then you're going to love this product. What do you think?
I have not distilled my thoughts into a manageable stream yet. It is a chaotic maelstrom of nonsense in my head when it comes to this phone, because I tell you what, I was so excited for it for all the reasons you just stated. I got the review device in, and on my first outing with it, despite having had an hour-long, very useful briefing with Sony people who really know what they're talking about and who were awesome, and who told me, it answered every question, which is rare, as you both know. I spent an hour with this thing on a lovely Brooklyn dusk, and it shattered my confidence in myself and made me want to just go into the woods without technology for a week, like Russell Holley.
Jesus Christ.
Oh,
and,
God.
And if anybody is a pro with managing like a pro mode in a camera, you should be able to handle it.
I should be able to, right? Well, and here's the thing. We all live in a world where phones are increasingly relying on computational solutions to delivering a good photo. You know, it's even if you don't have a Pixel where you just kind of point at it and shoot and, well, it's going to come out okay usually. Most phones are at least applying a lot of AI and other solutions to help you out. This phone does it completely differently. It's like, it's going to happen in camera. We're going to make this photo happen in the moment, and you are going to use a Sony interface to do that. A Sony interface that's pulled not from the Alpha line, which David Kogan helped me realize from the Unlocker, because I use a Sony Alpha camera every day to shoot my YouTube videos. It's not pulled from that. It's pulled from the grade above that. Their actual professional cameras, not their prosumer one. And man, I tell you what, it's not an interface that is forgiving or makes any sense, really, to me.
Or translate well the touch, I assume?
Yeah, it's okay on the touch thing, but it's really like, it is a camera, it is a piece of camera software that allows you to put this phone on a tripod, hopefully a $1,000 tripod, because, you know, let's not mess around.
As
and
you
then
do.
Set your exposure and set your aperture and set all this stuff for that one shot you need. And then you need to take 45 minutes with your crew, break down that shot, move to another location, set up again. It doesn't adapt. You can't like just kind of run and gun with it. You need to have a shot list and a storyboard and, again, like a crew of 50 people and a crane with you if you want to make the most of this phone. And honestly, it's off-putting to me at this point. I'm not having a great time.
It just sounds like my experience of using the other Sony phones over the last 5 years or so. They didn't have as crazy of a pro mode, but the pick up, point and shoot image was never touching the capabilities or what you knew that the sensor was or the hardware was capable of. You had to go into manual mode to get the most out of it.
Right. And here's the thing though, like I think the automatic mode, I think they're the camera app that everyone knows when they talk about a smartphone camera app on this phone, I usually get better results from it. And I think I've had pretty good luck with Sony phones over the past few years. I think those photos and videos, I'm going to have some cool stuff to show for it. It's just that I have memories of other phones, the Lumia 1020, first and foremost, the Huawei stuff, most certainly, that not only challenges you to live up to its potential because it is so great, but gives you an interface that doesn't punch you in the face within the first 10 minutes and tell you to go back to school because you don't know what you're doing. This phone is not made for any of us. It's not made for anyone I know. And so I'm going to seek out some more feedback from actual pros. My problem is, yeah, the interface looks like a pro professional camera, but it's not backed up by a lens that's the size of, you know, a beer can. So you're never going to get the results that you would from a professional camera anyway. So I'm left wondering again who this phone is for. So we will have to see. Again, it's early for me, but you know,
I mean, what's interesting is, you know, I was watching. I don't know if you've seen CNET's review of this phone. They put out
Patrick did one, right?
Patrick Holland put out a 15-minute review of the 1-2. And it's amazing. The review is amazing, right? The actual production quality of it, the fact that he spends the last 6 minutes of it showing us a video that he made on the on the phone itself. But what's interesting about it is that this appears to be the person that Sony is after, right? The person who wants to create content with this phone. But based on what you said, it appears that Patrick is viewing the constant attention this phone needs as a positive thing, as a, you know, you need to basically baby the interface all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're not going to get the results you need. And that, to some people, is actually a positive thing because it's almost like a neutral frequency response on a pair of headphones.
Yes.
You know, it's the reference headphones of cameras, I guess.
Yes. And that really hews to the philosophy that Sony was communicating to me in our briefing, where it was like, yeah, you can look, this is not a thing where you kind of shoot a shot that is okay, but then you save it in editing. This is a camera for you to get it in camera the right way the first time. And I get that. It's, you know, it's certainly not me. I was really hoping that I could maybe replace my iPhone 11 Pro Max as my run and gun B-roll shooter when I don't have time for a real shot. I just need to get something quick with this because it certainly has a lot more tools. But it's not for that lifestyle. It's for a very different kind of mobile filmmaking. So I don't want to condemn it outright. I'm just right now in my very early part of the process. I'm not having a great time and I need to learn more. I will say that that really sucks because the thing that makes this phone most worth pre-ordering is the fact that you get, what, those $250 noise-canceling earbuds for free right now, but that deal ends in something like a handful of days. I don't know what day it ends. It might be the 21st. And I'm not going to be ready by then, you know? I'll have to run exactly the same video I ran last year, which was, hey, this phone's pretty good. It's good for some people. If you're one of those people, oh, sorry, I wish I'd been able to tell you about this a week ago. You know, I'm grateful to have it, but I don't know why they're doing that.
What is the purpose of releasing a phone? Because it comes in three stages, right? There's the announcement, which was like early May or late April, I feel. Then there's the distributing the pre-production models to YouTubers and other sites. We don't have one yet. and then there's the release, there's usually like a two and a half month delta between those periods. And I'm wondering, you know, LG does this, but Sony does this more often, and it just seems more egregious when they do it.
Yeah, I do not have an answer. I mean, maybe it may be a matter of them trying to drive a certain number of sales inside a certain window so they can quantify it. And I don't know. Maybe they feel like they've gotten enough word of mouth already because, as you say, Patrick's review was really cool. I haven't watched his video yet, but, you know, it's gotten a big wave already. It has a lot of buzz in my comments. People are yelling at me, wasting my time on 17-year-old phones when I could be talking about the One Mark II. And it's like, I'm going as fast as I can.
Got to give the people what they want.
Do you, Daniel?
We'll see. I guess we'll
sometimes
talk about.
People don't know what they want.
We'll talk about your other project in a bit.
Yeah.
But I do want to kind of talk about this in light of the Huawei P40 Pro Plus. Give us your 30-second, you know, elevator pitch review of the camera, because we talked about the software situation to death already. I don't want to go back there.
Yeah. Huawei always leaves me feeling sad because we can't get them. And the reason for that is the camera. when I stopped using it to move on to the next phone, which I think was the One Mark II, I think it went, they were back to back. I immediately that day, the same day that I woke up reading comments on my videos saying, no one takes, this extreme zoom is just a stunt. Nobody needs it. People don't shoot that way. That same day when I didn't have the phone, I saw a bumblebee that landed just a little too far away, a helicopter and a seaplane, but they both took off that were too far away. I could have gotten them with the P40 Pro Plus. I could have gotten great shots, and I couldn't because I didn't have a phone with that capability. So
would have been classic.
Don't sleep on it. Like, that zoom is useful. 100x isn't, but that zoom at 20x, 15x, that's pretty useful stuff. So I miss it.
I was in the same boat yesterday. I was walking my daughter in her stroller to the park. This beautiful cardinal. If you're not familiar, there's a lot of Blue Jays and Cardinals in Toronto where I live.
I've heard of the baseball
Why would you be
team.
Familiar with
yeah.
that?
Enough about baseball, folks.
Shut the. Anyway,
I didn't know you lived in St. Louis.
65 games, Michael. 65 games. That's what they need to compromise on. All right.
Yeah, we'll see.
So I have the Pixel 3 XL in my pocket right now, because mm-hmm. I'm using it on the Android 11 beta. Okay, first of all, side rant. You know, you can reclaim your time if you want, Michael, but just give me this for a minute.
Take it.
The wide angle front facing camera on the Pixel 3 series is bar none the most enjoyable selfie camera I've ever used. Mm-hmm. And I remember you saying how much you liked it. Now that I have a kid, doubly so. Mm. Like, it is the most, these photos are incredible. I have dozens of them to reinforce that fact. It is so cool to be able to get like 2-3 people in a photo and the background, and it's perfectly processed using, you know, Google's HDR Plus. It's just like, it's like chef's kiss good. And it just Preach. Made me regret the fact that Google decided to cut that angle by 15 degrees or so when they unified the two cameras in the Pixel 4 series.
Yeah, it was 7 degrees, right? It went from 97 to 90, I think.
The Pixel 4 has a 90-degree wide angle camera?
I believe so.
It feels much closer than that.
Yeah, it's amazing how much 7 degrees.
I guess those 7 degrees have, you know, an obviously pronounced effect. Anyway. But I wanted to capture this cardinal, and obviously I couldn't on the Pixel 3 XL without it going to all to hell. And it reminded me that a year ago right now, I was in Turkey, and I had the Huawei P30 Pro with me, and I basically spent the entire trip just taking photos with that 5X or whatever zoom. Yeah, 5X zoom.
Yeah.
And it was great. It was the most fun I've had taking photos with a camera in my life.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's a perfect blend of capability and fun. When we were doing the P20 Pro, or I forget which one it was, who knows? We were in Paris shooting with one of the P series phones, and everyone else really loved their Eiffel Tower photos, and I loved mine too. But my favorite shot of that entire few days in Paris was being able to shoot a pocket watch through the window of a jeweler who was closed. And I was able to frame it up perfectly only because I had that much optical zoom at my disposal. I mean, these things are wonderful machines. They're just incredible.
Well, and speaking to Daniel's field of view comment, it really does make a difference to have a proper, narrower field of view on a zoom lens versus digital zoom on what is ultimately a wide angle lens. It really gives you an actual difference. It's like just a subconscious look to Yes. a telephoto shot that is actually different when you put them side by side.
Very much so.
I have a question for you, Michael, because you've got more experience with this than most people. What is your favorite wide angle camera to shoot with right now?
Oh, that's fun. So yeah, wow. Well, just to get off the Huawei love train for a second, I'm really bummed that they reduced their wide angle substantially.
Right.
I think it was last generation they did that actually, but I don't know when it was, but oof. You know, when I'm taking out, that's a tough question there, Bader. I want to say it's the iPhone 11 Pro Max because of its color consistency. You know, most phones, you jump out to that ultra wide and all of a sudden you're like, oh, I am very much dealing with a different camera here. These colors are all different. But I think the iPhone 11 probably does the best job at preserving the authenticity of that, of the scene when you hop out to ultra wide. But there's an Android phone that I'm forgetting to mention here, and it's going to drive me crazy when I eventually do remember it. It used to be LG, but then they shot themselves in the foot by limiting their own field of view as well. And then Samsung, that's what it is. The Fold, I use the Fold all the time, and man, that thing wants the world to be a comic book with how it treats color. But the ultra wide is fun. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's got to be the iPhone 11 for me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's just you're right. The consistency between the cameras is unmatched.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well,
although,
you know,
as much as, and I'll stop talking about Huawei after this, but as much as I'm annoyed that they didn't make as wide a lens, being able to apply a night mode that Huawei brings to a shot to the wide angle or even to the telephoto, that's pretty incredible. Because sometimes the shot just isn't working until you turn on force night mode and you get that hyper HDR effect and you're like, oh, now this I can do something with. It's kind of garbage right now, but I can snapseed it until it's better. And you just don't get that much information in anything but a Pixel, which doesn't have a wide angle camera. So that sucks.
Do you use Snapseed still over
I love Snapseed, yeah.
All 10 of the Photoshop apps that are in the Play Store right now?
Fun fact, I do not know how to use Photoshop in any of its forms.
Yeah. Even the, I feel like there's a new Photoshop app version in released every week. There's now the Photoshop Camera app, there's Photoshop Express, there's Lightroom, there's, I don't know, yeah, there's a half dozen Photoshop variants.
I love Lightroom on the desktop, but I get by just fine with Google Photos editing sliders. I feel like I can usually just tap auto and then open the sliders and tweak things from there, and I get along just fine.
I put a high premium on user interface. So the Snapseed, like being able to just kind of glide through Snapseed and to the point where I make the same comment about Final Cut all the time, where I feel like I can dance with it because the interface design is almost that good. Until they discontinue it, I'm going to keep using it because it's just so much more fun than messing with those other ones for me.
Yeah, I go back to Snapseed a lot. It actually works really well. But I'm not even lying. So you search Photoshop on the Play Store. There's Adobe Photoshop Express. There is Adobe Photoshop, which is a Photoshop Mix, which is like a cutout combine. You know, there's the regular Photoshop Camera app that came out last week. There is Photoshop Fix, which is like a heel app for blemishes and stuff. And then there's Photoshop Sketch. And then there's Lightroom. And then
Brush.
There's Illustrator.
All right. For Lightroom, do you have to pay for the Adobe suite? Do you use it?
No. I think if you have Creative Cloud, it will add features, but I don't believe it's... Actually, I'm not sure.
You have to pay for cloud storage if you want it to sync over to your desktop, and then at that point, you're paying for the app on the desktop as
yes,
well.
Yes, that's correct. Right. It's a free-to-use app, but it's all local if you don't have Creative Cloud.
Okay. But if it's local, then I'll use it. I shouldn't just bask in my ignorance. I'll download Adobe Lightroom for mobile and I'll try it out.
Lightroom on Android was garbage when it first came out, and it is now very good. I will give Adobe a lot of credit. They have spent a couple of years just like fixing the crap out of their Android apps, and they are now quite usable. So kudos to Adobe for that. Just clean up the number of Photoshop apps on the Play Store. What are you doing? All right. Let's take a... No, Andrew, we're going to talk about Pixel Buds and then we'll take a break. Okay.
Okay.
Andrew,
we'll make it quick then.
You just re-reviewed the Pixel Buds after 2 months. I cannot believe these have been out for 2 months already.
Whoa.
Weird.
You still like them, and you say that recent updates have actually fixed some of the Bluetooth connectivity problems that many people were experiencing. So walk us through.
It's crazy how much an update, which you were not notified about and you couldn't force to your earbuds, it just has to randomly happen in the background without you knowing. Yeah, could completely change the connectivity of the earbuds, both between them and between your phone and the earbuds. So a lot of people reported that they had these cutouts, you know, your typical kind of Bluetooth cutouts, but they would it would sound the same as if your phone was, you know, two rooms over, and maybe, you know, you forgot how far away your phone was and it kind of gets choppy and then it reconnects when you turn, you know, turn your head or whatever to be closer. But that would happen when the phone was in your pocket or in a backpack, or in my case, in a waist pack while I run. It would be kind of weird. And it was weird because it was the difference between having the phone, you know, facing outward in your pocket or inward in your pocket could be the difference between the Pixel Buds being perfect and cutting out all the time. And it was bad enough that it just got, you know, there was this huge, you know, threads on Reddit and the Google support forums, et cetera, where Google actually was able to release a firmware update that for me fixed the cutouts entirely. I only had them kind of intermittently in my original kind of first couple of weeks using them. I didn't think it was a big con because I just assumed, you know, Bluetooth is still flaky, but I haven't had anything. I can hold the phone any which way I want. I can, you know, do the typical put it in my pocket and cover it with my hand, which is usually kind of the way to get Bluetooth to cut out. Doesn't matter. Go on runs or walks, take phone calls, music. It doesn't matter. It just hangs on. And it's crazy that, I guess, first that it could be released that badly at the start, and then it could be addressed in a single firmware update. And at the same time, they also address this problem that I never thought was an issue. But when you pause, you get a couple seconds of kind of like a static or a hiss, kind of a bed of hiss noise that lasts after the pause. They killed that entirely, which again is like, how did you not, like, if it was that easy to fix, I'm sure it wasn't easy, but if it was fixable, how did it launch like this when, of course, we remember that these things took like 6 months after it announced to come out?
Because Google, I mean, Google does this the time.
That's how I started off
in beta.
It started off by re-review, so.
For patience for months and months. And then by, you know, every Pixel is really good by January. And you just, then they go on sale and then people start buying them. And then Ben Shun writes another editorial about how you should never buy a Pixel phone at launch. And, you know, the cycle continues.
Yeah. Hey, Ben. I mean, they're still expensive earbuds, and you have to be willing to pay extra to have this really nice small case and these really cleverly designed earbuds and the nice, really good microphones and the auto adjusting volume, like all these little things that are just really nice. And I just appreciate the design of them in order to spend that much, $180. But I just feel like it's worth it, especially when you don't have to then say, oh, well, but they have these intermittent connection issues because they just don't anymore.
I would bet money that this will not fix the problem for a lot of people. Like,
of course, you will find there
Bluetooth
will still be complaints.
Bluetooth is the most just unexpected. It has the most unexpected problems. They crop up all the time. They are nebulous and they will and just capricious. That's the word of the day.
Capricious. Ooh, capricious.
It is just it's a tire fire of a standard. And it's funny because, like, I have had no problem, for example, with Jabra's earbuds, Jabra's Elite 65Ts, 75Ts, all the active variants, no problems over two generations for earbuds, no problems. Our friend over at Android Police, David Ruddick, has had nothing but problems with those same earbuds. We hear about issues all the time with Jabra's quality control. So it is just one of those things. I'm guessing Google is trying to fix the problem as quickly as possible. I'm bringing this up in relation to Microsoft's first earbuds effort in the Surface earbuds, which I put a photo of myself on Twitter.
I was tea saucers. You got hanging
say,
on your
man,
ears.
I didn't recognize you without those poker chips in your ears. What are you doing?
Seriously, it's been an interesting 24 hours. I'm actually really enjoying this very opinionated product. It is something that, you know, Microsoft has done more and more often in the last few years is put out products that it stands behind as just having a very distinct design, having a very distinct set of features that it will back up with, you know, whatever software integration it thinks necessary. I do not care about using PowerPoint with my Surface earbuds. I do, though, appreciate the fact that they are not, they sound great and they have a full sound without being uncomfortable, and they don't have a ton of passive isolation. So they're open-ish, more like AirPods than they are like the Elite 75Ts or, you know, the Google, you know, the Pixel Buds. But they're fascinating to me. I think Microsoft got more right than wrong, but there's just some weird things that are not here. Like, there's no autoplay pause. There's no wireless charging. They look kind of funky.
How's the case size?
It's about the same.
It has to be pretty
big,
right?
No, it's not. It's not that big. It's squared off and longer than the Pixel Buds, but it's closer in size to like the Galaxy Buds.
Galaxy Buds case. I was going to say that's what I remember from the hands-on. I haven't seen them since then, but yeah, it's smaller than you would think, right?
Because that's kind of my thing is for true wireless earbuds, my benchmark now is it has to start with a really tiny case, or I just don't care.
Yeah, agreed.
And it doesn't have wireless charging, you said, on the case?
No, it doesn't.
Forget it. Come on, dude.
Yeah, that should be just
which
table
either
stakes.
To the Jabras, right?
Yeah. What? So Jabra advertised a wireless charging case as an add-on for the Elite 75T series back in January
AirPods.
At CES, and it's still not available. So I'm guessing it's not happening.
Talking about another capricious standard. I love me some wireless charging, but it annoys me, you know, every day, at least twice.
All the time.
Yeah.
Oh, that's it. That's your comment.
Yes, sir.
That's your tweet.
Yeah, just send it. But I will say that I'm excited to hear that Andrew got his firmware update on the Buds. Those things made a fool of me. They made a mockery of me because I gave them a glowing review after having 4 days of just uninterrupted delight with them. I hit publish, went outside, took a walk, and they immediately just started crapping the bed, not having a good, with all those connection issues. So I'm glad to hear that your firmware update has landed, Andrew. I have tried to apply that update 3 times. And then become so frustrated over the course of 3 minutes trying to make it happen that I've just left the room. So
yeah,
someday they'll update and I'll be happy.
For anybody else that's trying, the only way I got it to work was I just took them out of the case and let them sit there next to the phone connected for about a half hour. I put them back in the case and I put the case on the charger. And then when I came back to them about an hour later, they had done the thing. I have not seen a way to force or follow some kind of Konami code to make it work. But everybody just says, like, it'll happen. The problem is the Pixel Buds app says update available.
You can
tap the thing and it doesn't do anything.
It's grayed out. It is the biggest troll move I've ever seen.
Can I just talk about like ethics in YouTube journalism for a moment, Michael?
Yes, no. Yes,
because
please do.
I know you talked a little bit about this stuff with Marquez, but
yeah.
I just want to bring up one thing. Like that exact situation, the Pixel Buds are great during the time that you review it. You release a canonical review. It's, you know, 4 out of 5 or whatever equivalent. And then they're actually not nearly as good as you say they are in your review. And in fact, you would like to change that opinion.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? I mean, what is like for us, we go back to the site, we publish a re-review. You often do that 6 months later, but you don't really have the ability to just go back and make these edits to your video. So what's your thinking around changing the narrative of something that is so set in stone when you publish it?
It absolutely sucks. You cannot, unless you are a massive firm, and I didn't even know this until I did that podcast with Marquez. If you're a big company, you can go in and do a video replace, which is some crazy behind the scenes stuff that you have to know someone at Google for. Yeah. But no one can do that. Like no one can do that. So you have to leave a pinned comment if you're a reviewer who has put up a video and you want to change a conclusion or the price changes or the phone gets recalled a la Note 7 and you don't want to take the video down. You leave a pinned comment so everyone can see it. And that's about all. I don't even think I did that for Pixel Buds because it wasn't really like I had intermittent connection issues the day after publication. Then it was fine for a while. And then I realized I was getting frustrated more and more often. So I'm going to go do that today. Actually, thank you for reminding me. I'm going to tell everybody to be on 296. But it's an inherent limitation of the platform. And until YouTube comes up with a solution, it will continue to be. I will say that you were not always able to make the changes you're able to make now as a YouTuber. We can go in and like snip stuff out. If you say something you want to take out, if you can like take a sentence out, you can recut the video and not lose all your views and all your comments and all that. But it is nowhere near as easy as it needs to be for the kind of reporting that you can much more easily do writing an article, which you can then just paste six paragraphs to the top of if you want to the day after. It's great. I miss that.
It is. I mean, yeah, there is benefit to that, but it's also there's also an ethical minefield around editing published content and not disclosing as well. So we try to do both. We try to make it very clear where we make changes and what we've changed. Thank you for that. I appreciate you stepping on that minefield for us. all right, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back and talk about when phones were fun. Stay tuned. This episode of the Android Central Podcast is brought to you by SanDisk. Okay, Andrew, phones shouldn't run out of space anymore. That's, you know, we think about these things that they should just have infinite storage, but they don't. Especially some phones that we like to talk about a lot, they still come with 64 gigs of storage out of the box. Not enough.
Uh-huh, I have one of those right here.
So that's where solutions like SanDisk's Ultra Dual Drive Lux USB Type-C flash drive come in. It's made for Android devices with USB-C ports. Thankfully, that's most phones. And you can go in and you can install SanDisk's Memory Zone app and select photos, videos, music, documents, contacts, and anything else you want to move over. And then flip the whole thing around. And there's a USB-A drive if you have a legacy laptop or something else with a USB-A drive. Or if you have something with a USB-C drive, you just transfer it over there. It comes in storage sizes between 32 gigs all the way up to 1 terabyte of storage. And you can get up to 150 megabytes per second read speeds. So this thing is super fast. Obviously, there are a lot of use cases for something like this. But you know, tell me about when your phone that is not going to be named ran out of storage and what you used the Ultra Dual Drive Lux with.
Well, the biggest way that we use these types of drives, and I've used the previous version of this drive that was just a little bit slower, is when we're all traveling, we're out at trade shows, and we shoot quick photos or video clips, and we want to transfer them between phones or between phone and computer. We're like sitting at a hotel bar or something, or on the trade show floor back in those good old days, and we could just quickly plug into the phone, pull down gigabytes and gigabytes of videos, especially now that the videos are all 4K and they're really huge, and just plug them into the computer or plug them into somebody else's phone and quickly get them that way. And it turns a job that would take several minutes or an hour sometimes, depending on how bad the upload speeds are for something like Dropbox or Google Drive, into like a 2-minute process. And all of a sudden we have 4K video files just getting pulled between phone and computer. And you know, even if you haven't run out of space on your phone with too little storage, it's just a way to quickly get those photos and videos off. And then, you know, you can upload the originals onto your, you know, cloud storage of choice later on. But this just gives you access to them immediately instead of having to carry a USB-C cable around.
That is a great point. If you don't have a great internet connection, if you don't want to wait for things to upload to the cloud, you can just use SanDisk's Ultra Dual Drive Lux USB Type-C flash drive. And we have a special offer for Android Central Podcast listeners. If you want to use SanDisk to free up space on your phone, you can go to sandisk.com/ACP for 10% off your first order. That's sandisk.com/ACP. Don't wait, sandisk.com/ACP. And thank you so much to SanDisk for sponsoring the Android Central Podcast. All right, Michael Fisher. We have video that we use internally. I'm so sorry to people who want video back, especially to you, Sean. I know how much it means to you. We will do it one day, I promise. Episode 500 is coming.
Michael is live from the panic room somewhere in Brooklyn.
But I just saw the phone that he was using.
Oh, so, you did.
You know, behind the scenes, it was the Galaxy Fold. This is the phone that has been in your pocket for what, 6 months or so now?
About 6 months. Yeah, 5.5.
All right. So you just published your 6 month later review. You're still loving it. You're still, you know,
yes,
dealing with its quirks, but overall, you're still loving it.
Yeah.
What's it been like on Android 10? Is there anything big that's different?
Yeah, they added a couple things. You know, some conveniences, little things like the built-in screen recorder, I think, is here now, which is handy if you're content creators like us. It futzes with a few things. I really liked the Android 10 update because all of a sudden you got gestures, but I use Nova Launcher, so that breaks them, and that sucks.
because gestures would make a lot of sense on that screen.
Oh, dude, last night, you know how many times I swiped in from the right side? Because I'm laying in bed, like, just scrubbing Reddit, and I'm like, oh, I can't swipe. Oh, I have to go. It sucked.
Trying to reach all the way down to that
back
button.
Wait, why can't you just use the
touch
launcher?
Not touch, One UI? I can. I just like the way Nova Launcher looks, and I like the way I can customize it and use my own icon packs and stuff. But it's been really great. I do encourage people to watch that episode of Into the Fold. It is the most recent one. And my favorite thing about it is it hasn't broken. And most of the people I know who also carry them on the internet, you know, theirs haven't broken either. It's just so it's such a tragic thing that that's the third question I get asked by everyone who sees me using it. What is that? Oh, is that the fold? Oh, is it broken? It's really fragile, right? And I'm like, it's more fragile than most phones, yes, but it's not going to break if you look at it funny. There's a great video from a contractor on YouTube who reviewed it, actually. And he was like, he takes it on the job site every day. It's amazing.
You know what? It did kind of let, you know, it helped me think about how a folding phone could be used in enterprise, in the enterprise market, right?
Yes.
You know, when they, I mean, if you think about it, right? Like, yes, the internal screen is inherently softer, but the fact that you are folding on top of it means that you can protect it more easily.
The whole reason we came up with clamshell phones in the first place 20 years ago. Yes.
As long as the sufficient protections are in place they should have been from day one. But
true. Yeah. Well, yeah, don't get me wrong. Samsung dug its own grave with this thing.
Yeah, they stepped in a real hard to start.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's not deserved. I'm just saying that is not the device. You know, it's like, what's the analogy? You know, it's like you build a prototype car and the test driver gets killed because it's a prototype, but it reaches production and you fix that problem, but it still carries the stigma of that, you know, of that crash.
I felt a little, I mean, this is kind of off topic, but I felt a little bit about that with the SpaceX launch last couple of weeks, right? Like the early tests for the Falcon rocket when it was landing on those docks in the ocean.
On the drone ships,
The drone ships, they blew up a lot of the time, or they weren't successful. And it wasn't that long ago that the last one did not go so well. And yet there was enough confidence that they had fixed those problems and that they wouldn't happen again this time. And the last, I think, three or four landings have been flawless.
Yeah.
And I think NASA is even willing to take for granted that era of, you know, that you know, the rockets essentially disintegrating upon landing is over. Yeah. And that's great.
It is. So yeah. The key difference is, I don't want to sound like an apologist, because the key difference is, of course, it wasn't a prototype. It was being sold to people and it was breaking way too easily. So that, yeah, it should never have happened this way. In the same way, you don't put crew on an experimental rocket, you know. Unless it's the space shuttle rip. Go ahead.
Well, the good thing is that these long-term impressions seem to be that it's held up way better than anybody would have thought, even considering that the bar was pretty darn low.
Yes.
And that will hopefully be resurfaced when we start talking about a second generation fold, and everybody will, you know, start to go back and ask those questions and revisit the original, because that's really the only way that you can rebuild confidence is, you know, when you come out with the next one, look back at those previous ones and like, assess how bad was it? How bad are the Galaxy Z Flips that have a slightly better technology on the screen covering? Mm-hmm. How does that compare to, you know, what we're seeing going forward? And that's really the only way they can erase it. It just stinks that they've had to start from a negative position rather than a neutral one.
Yes, very true.
Okay, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, your most recent video is about the Jelly 2, which is the the small phone that you are now recommending to people.
Yeah.
It is a sequel, obviously, to the first Jelly phone. Mm-hmm. It is by a company called Unihertz, which has a checkered history, I would say, of releasing.
I would say it's a ridiculous record of humoring and unexpectedly, occasionally delighting, but mostly confusing us. Yes,
that BlackBerry clone you showed off on your keyboard phone videos was just horrific.
Oh my god!
I have actually defended myself with a Titan before because it is such a massive object.
Aptly named. Then it can make this little jelly. Is it officially the Jelly 2 or Jelly Phone 2?
The Jelly 2, my friend. Yeah, it what a pendulum swing too, because that Titan, I did not really hold any punches on that Titan on the keyboard phones video because it's just a direct ripoff. And I think the only reason BlackBerry didn't end up suing them is because they didn't think it was going to be worth it. Because they just ripped off the Passport and it features and all. Some of the interfaces even copied. But the Jelly 2 is this, it's pint-sized little, the 3-inch phone that runs Android 10. And at every turn, because of the Titan, I was like, this is going to turn to crap right now. Here it is. Here's where I start to hate it. And it never happened. The only thing it does poorly, and really poorly, is the camera, which you expect from a very cheap, very tiny, niche phone for nobody. But everything else is so much fun.
Thought it was great at the end that you mentioned that it does the Palm phone idea dramatically better for less than half the price.
Yeah.
And without all the pomp about it, saying like, oh, well, this is the companion phone to this phone and you have to be on Verizon and there's all this like lifestyle-y stuff. Right. This is just like, well, we made a tiny phone and we think that there are probably people that want, like you said, a summer weekend phone.
Yeah.
That like pretty much actively discourages you from interacting with it for long periods.
Absolutely.
There's also something to be said for the fact that Unihertz, while keeping the form factor relatively unchanged, I mean, improving it in almost every measure in terms of aesthetics, just demolished the original spec sheet, right?
Better
screen resolution, larger display, much higher resolution cameras, double the battery capacity, Android 10 versus Android 7,
six gigs of RAM,
and 128 gigs of storage versus 2 and 16 respectively. You know, the original had a 950 milliamp hour battery, just like unacceptable even a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, this is what's the processor in it? I forget.
It's a MediaTek P60, I think.
Okay, so
it's
not
fine.
Particularly powerful.
It's not particularly powerful, but it also like flies because it's not driving that many pixels, and you really can't do enough to make it fall behind. It's so small that the minute you try to do a bunch of things at once, you're like, "What am I doing? This is no. That's right, not what
you're
this
not
is
multitasking
for.
On that thing."
Exactly. The only place that I felt the speed crunch or the power crunch on that processor was on the modem. I was standing next to my girlfriend, had her Note 10 Plus out. We're on the same cell site on T-Mobile. She's getting 21 down and 19 up, and I'm getting 6 and 6. You know, it's that's the only place it really slowed down. But my thing was, like, here's the thing. It's a great product. I don't know anyone in my real life who I would say, you need to go buy this. Because people who shouldn't be looking at their phone all the time or who want a minimalistic phone don't need everything Android 10 offers. And the people who keep saying in my comments, and they're right to an extent, it's a good running phone. It's a good phone to take out for a quick jaunt. And just it's a just-in-case Instagram phone or whatever. You know, no. A connected smartwatch is way better.
I run with my Pixel 4 XL or my Galaxy S20 Ultra. It's fine. But people run with even iPhone 11 Pro Maxes. Like, the doing things actively with a phone, with a large phone, is a lot easier to manage than swapping your SIM card to a different phone every time you want to go on a bike ride.
Right.
Or you leave the phone at home because you have a connected smartwatch.
You get a watch
that, you know, that still serves a purpose when you are back with your regular phone. The watch, you don't have to take your watch off when you move back into your phone. The Jelly 2 would just sit in a drawer when you're not, you know, doing whatever. So it's a confusing product. But again, you know, the real thing, and I wish I'd gone into this a little deeper in the video, is you're right. It's the Palm comparison. Palm had to drum up all of these reasons to adopt the Palm lifestyle. It had to like make you think it was cool in order to justify a, whatever it was, a $400 launch price. And its performance was crap, and so was its battery life, right? So like this thing is, if you're thinking about a Palm phone, you should just go get the Jelly 2.
Such, I mean, the other part of it, $30,
yeah, was that the Palm phone was a CDMA exclusive product for most of its life.
Oh, I had forgotten about that.
So it was a Verizon thing.
Yeah.
Most people didn't have access to it. It wasn't just something you could buy off Amazon for $200.
Right.
You know,
I just think that it's very cool that they're doing this thing.
Yeah.
And they're going so below even the smallest like Xperia X2 compact from 4 years ago. Like they're going tiny. It's a 3-inch display. And so it really is almost to the level of being absurd, but it's just very fun.
Yep.
Speaking of which, I brought my Xperia XZ2 compact out, whatever it's called, a couple days ago, and I applied all of the patches that it had since, I believe, June of 2019.
Wow.
And Sony does not do it doesn't do unified updates. It does seamless updates, so it has to hit each one over the course of 2 days. I updated this phone. it was excruciating, but
did you like it when you were done? Like, what did you resume the compact dream?
I love it. I do. Yeah. I so love this form factor, Michael. I wish more phones were this size. I mean, that's kind of why I dig the iPhone SE. I bought myself an iPhone SE, and I've been using it more than I've been using my iPhone 10, 10 or whatever it's called, 11 Pro. All right, let's talk about your other series that is apparently just blowing up the internet right now. When phones were fun. So
thankfully,
this has been kind of a labor of love for you, I would say, over the last little bit.
Yes, sir. Yeah, this is my new favorite thing.
It started with the Matrix phone, which was part of the Matrix Reloaded back in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, Jose deserves so much props for that thumbnail.
I know.
Incredible.
I say it to anyone who will listen. Jose, my thumbnail designer, a super genius.
1.2 million views right now, by the way. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Quite unexpected, frankly. When you're launching a new series and it's as esoteric as, hey, phones were a lot more fun 20 years ago, you don't know that it's going to be a success at all. So having that be one of the two videos that's crossed the million mark in less than a month is great. Or in a month.
Okay, so walk me through the just the sheer breadth of this, because you have a lot of options. You have a lot of phones to choose from. Mm-hmm. With the first two, you were focusing on individual phones, right? The Matrix phone and then the Motorola Aura. Mm-hmm. The third and fourth were series, right? With the Sidekick and then just every ridiculous Nokia phone between 2001 and 2003.
Yes.
Walk us through how you decided to fit this into your schedule.
So here's the thing. We're all familiar with the idea of, hey, it's a slow news week. We don't have a new phone in. We don't have a new computer in. But I could eBay this laptop from 1997 for $40, and that could be fun to look back and see how far we've come. I've been doing that for ages. Pocket Now, where I've got my start, they've been doing the Pocket Now throwback for longer than that. And so the format is not new. It was the packaging of it that I stumbled upon as a result of quarantine. I don't watch a lot of YouTube videos. I don't know if you guys do. I spend so much time creating YouTube videos that I just don't really like watching them for some reason. And I ran into my exception because I ran out of Netflix and I was just staring at the TV, waiting to not go outside because, you know. And I started just binging a YouTuber called LGR, which stands for Lazy Game Reviews. And this man has made a life basically running old software on old computers from the 90s that he builds. And the reason this was instructive for me was that each one of those videos had like 300,000 views, every single video of his over the course of the past decade. And I realized that if you package it in a digestible way, that people will be like, okay, well, you know, instead of people coming to a channel and saying, well, I wonder if Mr. Mobile has something to say about the Huawei P40 Pro Plus, and instead he's talking about a two-decade-old phone, you kind of tune out. You're like, ah, that's not what I'm here for. But if you package it as a series where you're like, no, this is what we talk about, and we do it once a week, and I take you 20 years back in time, and we talk about my first camera phone, people not only show up for that, but in a time when the world seems to be absolutely falling apart at every conceivable seam, people are even more predisposed to that existing nostalgic impulse than they would otherwise be. And I am more disposed to create it because, God, I need an escape too, right?
Yeah.
So it was just the confluence of perfect timing, and the idea for the title came to me in the shower. If you take your showers with your phone, that's the thing. Don't take your phone into your shower if you can help it. I do it a lot because I tweet from the shower a lot. Don't do it. It's the last refuge of like original creative thought where you don't have a screen in front of your face. Don't take your phone to the shower.
Ruined it.
Why do you do that? What do you need to do? Why do you need to tweet in the shower?
I continue my listening to my podcast that I was listening to when I get in the shower.
That's what I used to do, and then I got a Google Home speaker in there, so now I'm better off. But yeah, to answer your question, I kind of start the email onslaught in the morning. I start chipping away at it in the shower so that I can swipe away all the overnight pitches. But I'm going to stop doing that because I clicked a spam link by accident. I wasn't awake yet. Don't take your phone in the shower.
That's what you do. I got a very, very good Netflix phishing email yesterday.
Ooh,
I didn't
really.
I mean, wasn't close to clicking on it, but like, it was extremely, extremely good. And
watch out, somebody.
Yeah,
I worry about this, man.
Me too. You should. It's. They're getting better. You got to be careful out there, everybody. Wear your mask. Don't click on spam links.
So I know where I'm spending 29 minutes and 49 seconds. Nice. It's watching LGR's The Windows Me Experience. Was it that bad?
Yes. It's a great video. Love that one.
I haven't watched it. I'm very interested. Thank you for sharing that YouTube channel with me. Okay,
absolutely.
What's coming up next for you for When Phones Were Fun?
When Phones Were Fun, coming up tomorrow as we record this, so it'll be live by the time this goes up, I think. Is my first camera phone. It is not the first Samsung camera phone. It's not the first camera phone. It's not even the first Sprint camera phone, but it is the A600, and it's notable because it was the first to make shooting with the phone not so awkward, thanks to some innovations that are still really cool 17 years later. Hmm. So I'm just very excited to push it live, even though I'm aware that it's not going to be like the Matrix phone or the Aura. It's not going to take off. This is going to be a million plus video. But you know what? Sometimes the nature of YouTube is not just to serve a profitable end. The nature of YouTube is to serve itself. von Clausewitz. Yeah.
Right. Indeed.
So I'm very excited for that.
My first camera phone was the LG Shine. If you remember
the
that
LG
one.
LG Shine. I don't remember that one. What
yeah,
was
it? I remember the LG Shine.
Is it a slider?
When was it? It had a 2-megapixel camera.
Whoa.
It was slick at the time. What year was it? 2008. Yeah,
that was your first
late
camera phone. How about that?
Yeah, I had some, I had a flippy phone before then.
Okay.
I went very quickly.
Yeah, I'd have to remember the problem is I can't remember the model number.
Exactly. Yeah, they didn't all have nice names. I mean, then, LG actually was one of the only companies doing the predictable naming convention, or at least memorable naming conventions. It had the LG Chocolate, the LG mm-hmm. Secret, the LG Shine. Yeah,
then,
I mean,
then you had
were
the carriers
actually quite
giving them their own names. You had LG the V for Verizon, or NV, of course, these plays on words. Yeah, the one I know what you mean. The one I'm doing is the Samsung SPH A600. Which, right. Does not exactly roll off the tongue.
So I'll find it, but basically it's the the generic silver LG flip phone that has a 1.2 megapixel camera, and it has a mirror on the outside.
Oh, for selfies. Yeah.
Rather than an exterior like dot matrix display or anything, it has the mirror for selfies.
Did you have was it an OLED panel on the outside with flashing multicolored lights?
No, I thought it was just the mirror.
No. Oh, so no external display at all.
I'm looking. It might have been a singular device.
Oh, singular. David Amell showed me commercials from Singular back in the day last night as we were talking about old phones. And remember the Splat Man? Remember how horrendous that branding was?
Yeah.
So the best thing they ever did was buy AT&T and then decide, you know what? We're taking your name. It's better.
Oh, no. Okay, that's right. So I'm getting them confused because it did have an external LCD. This is the C2000. This looks as close as possible to what I recall. It had a camera with a camera like a shutter cover.
Oh.
And that was a mirror.
Oh, the mirror itself was the cover.
Was the little flippy shutter cover.
Oh, yeah. Now I see it. Yep.
Because much like the flip phone you were talking about, it's like, that was just to protect the interior stuff. Like that was still a time when we just had lots of physical covers for things. You still had a lot of USB port covers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and all that jazz.
And one of the amazing things about taking apart old tech dudes is, by the way, there are tons of people out there who are very awesome people and will send you stuff or send me stuff more properly just so that it can be seen on video. The only reason I have an A600 is because one of your Canadian friends, Daniel Bader, and by friends, I just mean another Canadian citizen.
No, we all know each other.
was nice enough to just to buy a unit for me and ship it. I tried to pay him repeatedly. I even said, listen, it's not my money. We have a budget for this. It's fine. And he was like, no, I couldn't possibly.
What a gentleman. What a nice gentleman. Person.
Thank you, Mike. And thank you, Martin, for all your Nokias and yada, yada.
I loved your Nokia VO, by the way. Where you got the numbers confused.
Oh,
constantly.
My God. 3650? 3650.
I just, like, if the mistakes got into your final voiceover, I can only imagine how many of them were in your drafts.
What a disaster. I was selling phones in 2003. I remember how hard it was to tell a 3560 from a 7650.
Even though they all looked so different.
It's so different.
Too.
And then the series didn't even make sense. You have a wild-looking 7600 right next to a phone that looks normal that's like the 7520.
Yeah.
Anyway, but what was the thing? What was the other thing that's amazing? Oh, I don't remember what it was, but it was debug codes. I had to go and hunt through 15-year-old forum posts last night to try to find the field test codes to get into old phones. And so you could demonstrate that, like, extending the antenna on these old things actually did affect the RF. That was like a conspiracy theory back in the day. Like, it's just a piece of plastic. They just put that on there to make you feel better. It doesn't really do anything. All those people who said that are from Long Island, by the way. And then you would fire up the field test screen and then, oh, there it
or
is.
Boston.
Yep. See, I can't do the Boston accent without swearing, so I can't do that.
Well, we can beep it. It's fine. But then it's not worth it. All right.
Yeah.
I was looking up I guarantee you, by the way, when you were talking about your phone and Andrew was looking up his, everybody on listening to this just stopped listening for a few minutes while they went to eBay or Wikipedia to find their own first phone.
Yeah. So I could get one for $15, apparently.
No, don't. Hayato bought an HTC Inspire 4G for $37 off eBay. He's reviewing it for AC.
Just posted some photos on Twitter as we were broadcasting, and they look tremendous. Seeing, and this is what's fun about this too, seeing an old phone photographed with modern equipment and modern techniques is
thinking that.
It's like, wait, what? Because every video from back then is like, you know, a 480p quick and dirty camcorder video uploaded to a YouTube that didn't even exist yet. Almost.
It's every review I've ever recorded.
That's not true at all.
It is absolutely
true. Been the funniest contrast is seeing these tiny little pixelated displays shown in 4K on YouTube. It's like, there's no way they were that bad, but they were.
They were.
They're like 150 by 150 or something on this tiny little thing.
I will tell you, I just remembered what I was going to say. The biggest surprise to me, dudes, has been the unexpected physics lesson. you unbox these things after you get them for $30 on eBay or whatever. And you know, the covers, the rubber covers that used to cover up things like the headphone jack or the charging port or the stoppers that will prevent a flip from crashing down onto its keys and scratching the screen. All that stuff is rubber, and it's synthetic rubber, and it undergoes a process called rubber reversion, which I had to look up, and the folks at Polymer Solutions taught me all about it with their awesome website. And the rubber literally reverts over time to its constituent components. So you open up this phone that's otherwise in good shape, and these stoppers that are supposed to prevent the screen from scratching on the keys have turned to goo, and you get these stringy latex strands just like careening across the device. And you're like, oh, gross, because the rubber's liquid now. And you have to kind of, I imagine, I have no context for this, but I was wiping off a lot of that crap from the A600 yesterday. And I was like, is this what it is to change a diaper?
No.
Is this what it is? No?
No, it's worse.
Well, it depends. Oh, okay. It depends on the age of the baby. But I think at the beginning, it's a little bit more like that. Mm. But I mean, ideally, you don't get anything on your hands.
Oh, I got it all. I was very dirty after this.
I actually loved the little chemistry episode there, because it's a very well-known thing in cars from the late 90s and early 2000s.
Oh.
There are a lot of Ferraris and Porsches in particular that were really well known for having every single button in the entire control stack just turned to the goop.
Oh, awful.
Because you're trying to sell like these classic cars, you know, they're not $37, they're like $300,000.
Right.
And the buttons are all just goopy and gross.
Oh,
and there's like a process by which you can replace all of the front buttons.
Jay Leno's entire collection is just like melting in his garages.
It's slowly turning into
just a sea of
rubber.
Black
so
rubber.
It's a funny thing, because everything before that is fine, and then apparently we figured this out, and you know, everything after that is fine. There's just like this 10 to 15 year period right when all these phones were being made where they just, I guess, didn't think about, you know, would this Nokia 3560 really be in use?
Right.
25 years.
Because they're
later.
Not made to last like that at all. No. And it's there's a little cottage industry of like the last remaining part of YouTube that's like weird old YouTube. You can go find videos on how to re-vulcanize old rubber. And it involves like pouring talcum powder on it or something. Like there's a way you can save it, apparently. I just wipe it off, but ugh.
Eventually, though, it just disintegrates, and then you get to the T-1000 core underneath, and then it kills you.
And it
that's
right,
actually
yeah.
one thing that I found interesting, but I didn't really think about. You weren't able to actually use most of these phones, either because they were analog or 2G only.
That's the big bummer, man. Like, even when you throw your SIM
or
into it.
Or Sidekick servers are turned off.
Right, the servers haven't been on in a decade, and that was a server-dependent phone. Or your carrier is like, no, in the case of Sprint, we're like, we don't activate those devices anymore. And then you get into these really weird reasons. You're like, why? And you think it's a profit thing, but no, it turns out there was a security issue with the way those phones authenticated themselves on the network. So it's a security hole that they eventually had to close. And even T-Mobile, I'm like, GSM will save me. I'll just throw my SIM in with a SIM adapter. It'll be fine. But
that's what I thought.
T-Mobile in many markets has shut down its the GSM side, or they hasn't shut it down, but prevents authentication of edge-only devices.
Yeah, I think AT&T does the same thing.
Yeah,
which is
probably
wild.
Spectrum allocation, I imagine. I don't know, but
yeah. In T-Mobile's case, it's refarming,
right? So it is a bummer not to be able to like make phone calls on these things, or in many cases get the media off of them, because I've wanted to do an intro roll in glorious 10-second 10-second 128x160 video or whatever. But no,
I mean, we're going really long, but I love this conversation. I want to talk like. You bring up the fact that you can't really access edge networks anymore. T-Mobile's Volte network died on Tuesday night, Andrew. It just like there was a circuit overload, all the redundancies failed, and people all over the US couldn't make phone calls. And this was largely because analog phone calls are done on T-Mobile.
Yeah.
They've transitioned most of their network to IMS through Volte. Those connections were not being made. A lot of people thought it was just a denial of service attack, but it wasn't. It was one of their backhaul providers. All their servers died during a software update, and then the redundancies failed because the circuits got overloaded. Like it seems like a a power grid cascading failure equivalent in on the phone side.
And we saw that, I mean, relay out to now everybody else on all the other carriers thinks that their carrier has a problem because every phone call has two sides.
Right.
And, you know, they, the Verizon and AT&T customers thought that they had problems and they didn't. And T-Mobile customers thought they had a lot of data problems when really it was more like the voice network and the interconnects. And the funny thing was that T-Mobile came out and said, well, it wasn't that bad. Only 1 in 5 phone calls were not able to be made. Like
20% failure rate
of your phone calls. Like, we don't accept like anything less than like 5 9s of consistency in that phone call. And you're telling me 20% went down for something like 12 to 15 hours? Like, that's bananas.
Yeah. I mean, this is a company that when it eats Sprint and combines its customer base, will have 130 million subscribers. Right now, I think T-Mobile has, 80, 85 million. We talk about how phone calls are dead, but it is clearly not the case, especially right now.
Apparently not.
During a pandemic, people need to make phone calls. So, you know, the company's head of technology, Neville Ray, issued an apology blog post. A congressional group wants to investigate the FCC wants to investigate. Ajit Pai said that there will be an investigation. There have been calls for a congressional hearing into making sure that this doesn't happen again. There are some serious implications for your voice network going down for 12 hours or 8 hours or whatever it was.
Not a great start to Mike Sievert's CEO tenure.
No, yeah, no kidding.
John Ledger definitely spilt his margarita somewhere in the Bahamas when he saw this news.
I think he's a Verizon customer now, let's be honest.
Oh, savage.
All right. So I just want to mention before we go that we are currently doing our own sort of When Phones Were Fun project on the site. It's called Technostalgia. Hmm. And we now have 4 posts on Android Central that have been published as of our recording. There will be 5 by the time this goes live on Sunday. There are also 4 on Windows Central, 5 on iMore. And really, Michael, you inspired this. This was a conversation that we had internally about how we can leverage some of the excitement about nostalgia that's going around. Obviously, everybody is stuck at home. They're looking through their closets for old clothes and old tech, and they're just being more thoughtful about, you know, consumption in general and things like that.
Sure.
A lot of spring cleaning going on. And this got us to thinking, you know, how can we participate in this cultural movement? So a lot of us are writing about our first Android phones. Ara Wagner, who's been on the show many times, wrote about how she loves and misses Android phones with physical keyboards. And just today, Jerry Hildenbrand, who unfortunately could not be here today, he wrote a very, very incisive editorial called "Quit Lying to Yourself. Android sucked prior to 2017. So not at all controversial and is definitely not blowing up the internet right now. So I encourage you to go to the website and read it. We've also embedded a bunch of your, Michael's, videos on there. So you can go check those out as well. Michael, so you said your next video is going to be about your first video phone. What else do you have in the pipeline for the rest of June?
Yeah, first camera phone, not video phone, importantly, because that later. That's what made people buy the next one, you understand. The videos that will follow include, speaking of weird networks that were occasionally prone to failure, but otherwise pretty solid, I'm so looking forward to When Phones Were Fun, Nextel.
No.
Special place in your heart.
Absolutely. Miss it so much.
I feel like you have to have an iDen video on an annual basis,
to keep the dream alive.
Find a way to push to talk in your videos once a year.
I got to figure out how to get past the registration issue, because if iDen phones couldn't register on the network, they just wouldn't even let you play with them. So I got to figure out how to get past that. Nextel. Also, messaging phones. I'm going to do a whole phone, another Nokia-like roundup where I just get a bunch of them, and just those QWERTY dumb phones that came out when texting was blowing everything up. Fun fact, one of those is responsible for me joining Facebook because it had a Facebook Java app. So thank you for nothing, LG rumor. And there's a few more cool ones in the hole, and then, you know, we'll just get deeper and deeper as we go in. I'm going to do one about polyphonic ringtones. I'm going to do one about LEDs. There is a bottomless well of past to draw on, so I intend to keep mining it for as long as people will watch.
The summer of physics is what we're going to call it.
Indeed. Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, that's amazing. I encourage you to check it out. That's very cool. Good. And congratulations, honestly. Your last few videos,
thanks,
the
man.
Success is obviously so well deserved, but it's amazing to see you blow that 1 million view count.
Whew. I've been very, very happy to do it, and thank you. And I'm really glad that you guys are doing something similar, because I can't wait to watch. I assume Hayato's is going to be a video. Is that right?
It is. Yeah, it'll be a video.
I can't wait to watch that. And I'm going to look forward to reading the pieces this weekend, too. So,
and you're getting close to 1 million subscribers, too. So
thankfully,
that's going to happen soon.
I'm very eager to hit that and then immediately take a month off.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just slide back under that.
If you haven't checked him out yet, I mean, of course you have if you're listening, but go to youtube.com/Mr. Mobile.
Mr. Mobile. Please. Don't forget that.
You're also the Mr. Mobile on Twitter and Instagram, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Andrew, you're at Andrew Martinick. I am at Journey Dan. We are at Android Central. And I have an ask. I ask you for one thing every week. Email me at podcast@AndroidCentral with your first phone, the first phone that you bought. I love hearing about the early technology that made you into a phone nerd. We all have that story. I also have an ask. We haven't talked about it in a few months, but we have a sister podcast on the Mobile Nations Network called Jiggle Physics. It is a podcast hosted by three incredible women. It is about games. Right now, there are so many games, PlayStation 5, EA Play last night with Star Wars Squadrons, so much to talk about. Please go subscribe to Jiggle Physics. It is an amazing hour of gaming news and reviews and discussion that deserves way, way, way more listeners than it gets. And it just is an incredible, incredible experience. Please go subscribe and leave them, if you haven't already, leave them a review on iTunes or wherever you can review things. It really, really helps. So thank you so much for that. And with that, we will leave you for another week. We will be back next Friday with a post-WWDC breakdown of everything that Apple stole from Google this time around. My name is Daniel Bader. We will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Stay mobile.